we're going back to two very important developments in France. Two very important developments in France. Louis the Ninth. Does anyone know what Louis the Ninth is historically known as?
No,
that's the 14th. Louis the Ninth is historically known as Saint Louis.
I thought you said.
There you go, Feldman. Sometimes your wild guesses are right. I'm not sure. I know that's Jewish folklore says that that's why he. No, the Jewish folklore says that, but I don't know if there's any substance to it.
He definitely did it.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Let's go in order. Now, again, as you guys sort of basically know, there's no question that Louis the Ninth was no saint in Jewish history.
When is this?
Louis the Ninth reigned from 1223 to 1270. First important contribution to Jewish history in France was he slowly took away, through at least two different decrees, government backing to Jewish banking. Well, that was a major contribution. It's a negative contribution. You know, contribution can be viewed as positive or negative. This is negative, because if you don't have government backing, and you don't have a lot of people with swords willing to follow you, and you lend someone money and they don't want to pay you back, you're like stuck, you know? So taking away government backing to Jewish banking was very, very serious, as that was the one of the prime and definitely best money-making occupations of Jews in France. It was critical and very critical and deep blow to French Jewry. Now, after 1235, he actually forbade Jews from lending money to non-Jews with interest. But historians don't believe it was that significant, because the facts are he had already taken away backing earlier. And now he made a law which didn't bother enforcing that much. But again, you're not going to lend anyone serious money if you have no way to get it back. He also, one of the other things he did was, we saw earlier that Philip Augustus started the process of, making agreements with other French nobility, to not just wait a second, to not allow Jews to go from one place to another. Louis the Ninth did very significant work in that. And again, that's a contribution. That's not a positive contribution. That's definitely a negative contribution. Yes?
So, at least I think, Christians, it's like us, or for them to like be a banker or something like that.
Okay. You're right. That we spoke about weeks ago.
Right.
Initially, they held it was, they forbade it from one Christian to the other. Later on, I definitely know, by let's say the early 1500s, it was no longer usser, it was no longer forbidden for Christians to lend each other with interest. And I don't, it didn't make it into any Jewish history books that I know of, and I didn't even notice it in any general history books, so I can't really say much more about it. Yeah?
So I have to imagine then, after the Jews lost backing, they're not lending out that much big money anymore.
Obviously not. You're just not going to do it.
Didn't this kill the economy, or...
Did that kill the economy? I'm not sure. You're asking a very legitimate question. Did that kill the economy? France?
Expulsion.
The expulsion is actually much later. But French Jewry we'll see. There's another thing. Wait, just a second. The French Jewry is, physically and spiritually practically dead by the time it's expelled. Not that there wasn't anyone left, but it lost its vitality. And we're not talking about southern France, Provence. We're not talking about southern France. We're talking about southern France was basically independent at this point. It wasn't totally independent, but it was basically independent. So that we're not even talking about that. Now the other key.
What are you talking about?
We're talking about northern France.
Oh, what's
the topic today? We're starting out with French Jewry in the 1230s. And we're going on now, Louis the Ninth, known as Saint Louis. We're going on now to direct confrontation between the church and Christians and Jews. Okay, it's definitely true, as mentioned, in the Crusades, there was a certain amount of confrontation. But that was not really head-to-head. That was rather mob, basically mob-inspired, populist-style, violence against Jews. It wasn't. You'll see. So what we start now with.
Why didn't you want the Jews to have to stay in one place?
No. They didn't want. What they didn't want the Jews to do was to be able to go. See, before Philip Augustus, who's the king before Louis IX, when the Jews were expelled from one, dukedom, they just walked into the next one, and all these dukedoms weren't that large, so it wasn't expulsion. Was never. There were a lot of expulsions pre 1200, but the expulsions pre 1200 didn't have that much of an effect, because if you imagine New England-sized states, if you're expelled from New Hampshire, go to Vermont. You're expelled from Vermont, go to Massachusetts. And you could just go around. Okay, it's not the most comfortable thing in the world, but it's not, because your mobility is not that limited. Because mobility is not that limited, it doesn't.
So they want them to have to stay in the same place. So
That's right. They wanted their expulsions to really take effect. And there's no question that this policy was a religious policy. There's no question it was religious. I mean, it most likely had a negative effect on their economy. But contrary to contemporary life, life's idea is until, let's say, 1700, and probably even a little past it, making money was a factor in life, not the determining factor in life. Okay, now, again, we're starting now the beginning of confrontation, straight, direct confrontation. There was an apostate whose name was Nicholas Dunin, who told church officials, etc., that if you want to know why you have problems with the Jews, the problem is Shas. The problem is the Talmud. That's the problem.
So what was his name?
His name was Nicholas Dunin. So, he started agitating in the mid-1230s. He said, Shas blasphemes Christianity. Source of evil. And that's the real reason why Jews don't accept Yashka as Mashiach. So, to start things out, things weren't really done in a comprehensive scale. It was more like done place to place, seizures of Gemaras, etc., etc., etc. Finally, leading on to a famous trial of Shas in 1242. It was the very famous trial of Shas in 1242 in Paris. And, as they say, as Jewish historians say, the verdict was never in doubt. Shas was condemned. Shas was condemned and burnt in 1242. Shas was condemned and burnt. Now, I think I'll finish this off in the game. 1242. Now, what eventually happened, which I don't know, Chazan claims it's the normative, and I could probably I think he's like basically right, but not completely right. A little after this, it's not a little after this. Was an ongoing procedure of Jews appealing to the Pope over this issue, saying if you don't, without Shas we can't live, and that we consider that killing us. And eventually what happened, and it's oversimplification to call it the straight policy, because I can tell you right now, without having done real research, just from personal knowledge, that it was ons and offs. But the basic normative approach was to censor out, quote, the blasphemous parts. In other words, the Gemara is about Yashka. So, this is like important to know. When did those Gemaras just start disappearing? So in Christian Europe, they started disappearing a long time ago. No, we definitely have them back. The Gemaras in Yashka, there's about five of them. Bavli. There are about five of them in Sanhedrin, and a number of other ones scattered through Shas. A couple. And the one in Gittin, for some reason, was not censored out.
Is
What? It doesn't mamish. It's not a direct quote. Anachinami. I guess they didn't figure that one out. Didn't figure it out. Of course, you know, this was only applicable in Ashkenazi areas, but in Sephardic areas, it was not applicable. And I'm actually not sure. I will hopefully, when we get there, I'll be able to figure out if they actually did that in Italy or not. Because Italy has its own, you know, they're like their own thing.
The Vilna Shah says that it was replaced with Bilam in order to avoid getting burned.
There are places, specifically in Tehillim, there are extensive changes in Rashi because of this, but these are much later. These are Edom, you know, anti-Edom Rome statements were taken out, but that was not being done by the first level of censorship, of non-Jewish censorship over Shas, was about Yashka, was about, quotes, theoretically blasphemous statements in Shas. Okay, weiter. Now, Jewish folklore says, which I was not able to substantiate, but it's not just Jewish folklore, this is well known, like, you know, a lot of people, anyone who's like knowledgeable about Jewish history, even in a minor sense, should know this. Jewish folklore says that it was Shas was burnt in the exact same place in Paris that the Rambams had been burnt about 10 years earlier. 10, 11 years earlier. Yeah, that's right. That's what it says. And as we know, and I hope we're aware, this was considered a major tragedy. And the Maharam, who we should get to, we're definitely going to get to tonight, the Maharam wrote a kina about it. Maharam from Rottenberg, and we're going to get to him. I'm actually not sure which one's more famous. The Maharam in Rottenberg wrote a kina on it called Shali Sufa Ba'esh, which is said on Tisha B'Av, if you stay awake that long in the kinas. Yeah, okay. Okay, now, a part and parcel of St. Louis' decrees was that Talmud was usur, and it was basically impossible after this point in time to run a yeshiva in a country that doesn't allow you to have gemaras. So it's not going to work. And that's why there's rapid decline. And I'm not mamish sure if they were closed on the spot or they probably tried to like hide out, but whatever. Basically, this is the end of the Tekufas HaTosafson in France. So now, there's another piece of well-known Jewish folklore which goes together with the first one. And that is, as we saw earlier, one of the prime instigators against the Rambam. The prime instigator was Reb Shlomo min HaHar. Right? Reb Shlomo min HaHar. I spoke about him 2 weeks ago and last week. And one of his top Talmidim was Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah the Baal, the one who wrote Shari Tshuva. A Jewish folklore says, that's right. Jewish folklore says that Rabbeinu Yonah was so moved and so bothered that Shas was burnt in the same place as the Rambams, that he took that as rebuke from heaven, and that he was wrong to oppose the Rambam so much. That's what it says. Now, I looked a lot and could not find any primary source or any source from the times of the Rishonim that confirms this piece of folklore.
Rashi has a footnote about it.
Oh, they do? Yeah, what do they say?
I'm trying to find it here. It says the whole story that he went to
Israel. Yeah. Okay, no, they have, it's brought in here. But the question is, where is its source? Where does it come from? Where does that one come from? It's not in Shem HaKadosh. It's not brought in Shem HaKadosh. It's not brought. The problem is, it's sort of like this is the flip side. Like I say, how many Jewish historians have really seriously learned to Tosfos? So not that many, if any at all. I mean, very few, if any at all, have seriously learned Tosfos, and it takes time to really appreciate Tosfos. So the flip side of it is most people who print Shari Tshuvas are not that interested in history. So even though I looked through at least 8 different versions of Shari Tshuva, the people who print Shari Tshuvas are interested in Musar, and they're not interested in history. So I wasn't able to, none of them brought it. However, I was able, due to this version of Rabbeinu Yonah on Avos, He did give me a good marmakim for Rebbe. See, some people when they print a sefer, they print a mini bio, and this person did here, and he printed a snippet of a tshuva from the Rashbash. The Rashbash, Reb Shlomo ben Shimon or something like that. Okay, the Rashbash was in the late 1300s in Spain. The Rashbash was late 1300s in Spain, and he would.
The
Rashbash was descended from Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban, and they asked him, "How is it that you're descended from Rabbeinu Yonah and the Ramban?" So he explains, he's six generations back, that Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter married the Ramban's son. Wait a second. That's not it. Now you see why this, I consider this a pretty strong way to substantiate the theory. I mean the folklore. When Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter married the Ramban's son, and Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter, Ramban's son's name was Shlomo, and Rabbeinu Yonah died 1263. His daughter was pregnant and had a boy shortly afterwards. Now, according to the minig, as the Rashbash says, Shlomo, the son of the Ramban, had the right and almost obligation to name the son.
Yeah.
No. Moshe. Because their first boy is always named, Svardim named the first boy after the father's father. So his name should have been Moshe, but the Ramban, who was a Mechutin with Rabbeinu Yonah, said no. It says, V'harav Shemesh, V'harav Shemesh, V'yatza Shemesh. I'm not quoting the passage right. The sunrise, sunset. And because Rabbeinu Yonah just died, we should name this child Yonah instead of Moshe. And I'm a vater. I give over my rights for the name.
Ramban said this?
This is what the Ramban said. This is what the Ramban said. Now, again, here. Rabbeinu Yonah died in 1263. One of his daughters was expecting her first child, who's married to the Ramban's son. So we can definitely assume that this girl was, that the Rabbeinu Yonah's daughter was not that old. Okay? We can assume she was somewhere between 16 and 30.
16?
Yeah. Good girls got married much younger in the old days than they do today. And if you don't believe me, ask anyone of Sephardic descent.
I mean, Tosos.
What?
Tosos says it.
They married girls off.
Younger than 12.
That's right. That's right.
That's
right.
Right.
That's not.
No, that is not. Tosos writes, Tosos comes to the Gemara, this is Xer Jarabon, you shouldn't marry somebody younger than 12. Tosos comes on the spot. There's nothing, I forgot what Gemara is
saying. I'm not sure. Wait a second. Let's finish this off. Now, as we saw last week, the Ramban was the chief and prime defender of the Rambam. The Ramban, Nachmanides, was the chief defender of the Rambam. And I find it basically impossible to believe that Rabbeinu Yonah could have done a shidduch with the Ramban if he had not retracted his previous stance, anti-Rambam stance. Now, see, the Ramban's very complicated. Exactly, whatever. And we spoke about that last week at length, and if you want, you can listen to that shir. But I find it very difficult to believe that if Rabbeinu Yonah had not changed his opinion, that he could have done the shidduch with the Ramban. It's just not, whatever. It's just not going to work. It's not going to work. Yeah, so therefore, even though I was not able to find a primary source proving the story actually happened, nonetheless, I think we have very strong circumstantial. What? He must have retracted his opinion, because if not, I don't see how he could do a shidduch with the Ramban. Because the Ramban is very consistent. He wrote the letter in the 1230s. He wrote his Perish to Chumash. He wrote his Perish to Chumash in the late 1260s, after Rabbeinu Yonah died. He's very consistent. The Ramban is very consistent in upholding the honor of the Rambam. That the Ramban is very consistent in. That's a consistent. Again, no. Feldman, you're spewing. Kedarkach Yeshuar. We spoke with, they're not the exact same issue. I spoke about that last week. Was Rabbeinu Yonah Sephardi or Ashkenazi? Rabbeinu Yonah. Thank you. Rabbeinu Yonah was Sephardi, but he also learned in Provence, southern France, which no longer exists, and was an independent kehila, which was somewhat in between Sephardi and Ashkenaz. Ashkenaz. Feldman, it's not a football game. I can't resist. This is like sort of related to Jewish history. It's really related, but I can't resist. It's such a choice quote and classic misconception. I can't resist quoting this. This is a standard. Jews of medieval Western Christendom. Jews of medieval Western Christendom. Jews who lived in Christian Europe between 1000 and 1500. It wasn't that complicated, man.
I'm not as smart as you am.
Okay, now, this is a quote from, Louis the Ninth. Louis the Ninth? Known as St. Louis?
St. Louis.
St. Louis? St. Louis? I agree myself that no one who's not a very learned cleric should argue with them. If you're not very smart, don't argue with the Jews. A layman, listen to this quote. A layman, as soon as he hears the Christian faith maligned, should defend it only by the sword, with a good thrust to the stomach, as far as the sword will go. Wait a second, I'm not done. That's the quote from Louis the Ninth. Now here's the editorial comment of Professor Chazan, who teaches in NYU, for the records.
NYU or
YU? NYU.
Which one?
I'm quoting Chazan now. Okay. Given Louis' reputation as a man of peace, this is a stunning report, suggesting animosity of the deepest sort. You know what I say?
He says that's a page.
I say, Boker Tov.
This guy's not Jewish, right?
He's absolutely Jewish.
What? Jewish?
He's a Chazan, of course he's Jewish.
There's been a request, let's say that in more simple English for the records. Professor Chazan is very surprised that a person who historically is known for being a righteous, pious person, that's what he's known for. He is known for that. By general history, how could he say such a crazy thing that if you get into a religious argument with a Jew, there's only one thing to do: pull your sword out and stab him in the stomach. So he's like very shocked, and it's like let me finish this, and then you can have a comment. This is a very, in my personal opinion, a very typical statement. Of course, it's a little more open and radical than we've said in later times, but maybe not that much necessarily. Martin Luther said things at least as radical, if not more radical, as is well known. Martin Luther. Martin Luther, the theologian, the German theologian of the 1500s. Feldman, come on, please. I'm on that time. This is a typical statement which expresses and illustrates typical animosity and, conflict between Jews and non-Jews. And it's not, it's really a historical phenomenon amongst Jews themselves, even if they're not mamish religious, and sometimes even if they are, on how you view this type of issue. Like, if you've read The Prime Ministers, if you've read The Prime Ministers, you'll see that, Prime Ministers of Israel, had the similar, most of them would have also been surprised. whatever. I could give a couple of examples. I don't want to go too far off the topic right now. But one, someone like Menachem Begin would have been very not surprised by such a statement. And I think it's, and I definitely think that the historical substance could be very clearly substantiated that deep opposition to Jews, even though, I'll be with you guys in a minute, deep opposition to Jews is a constant in history. And the real truth is, the did I ever say the story of what's the guy's name? Van Passen? The Van Passen story I told you last year?
Possible.
Okay, I'll tell you this Van Passen story, and then we'll have time, a slight time out for questions. The Van Passen story is like this. There was a Dutch journalist whose name was Pierre Van Passen. Van Passen. Okay? He was very philo-Judaic. That means he liked Jews. He was active in American journalism between about 1920 till 1950. In the 20s and 30s, he was against British mandatory policy, which was limiting the amount of Jews coming into Palestine, mandatory Palestine. And in the 40s, he's very well known for joining up with someone who went by the name of Hillel Bergson. His real name was Hillel Cook. He was Reb Simcha Cook's first cousin. I don't think it's his brother, but I should actually check that out. Organizing a group of people to, oppose, Western Allied policy, which was called silent, apathy in face of the Holocaust. And he was very, Van Passen was very passionately on the Jewish side. Thank you. Now, he tells over a story when he was a teenager. He doesn't say exactly what I'd say, between 14 and 18. The infamous Kishinev pogroms happened. Kishinev pogroms of 1905. That was in Russia, but he was living somewhere in Holland, somewhere in the Netherlands. And there is a custom amongst people of non-Catholics, many Protestant sects have a custom of having the minister over for Sunday lunch. And that's like, it's a standard perk. It's like almost part of his salary. So anyway, Bekitzer, they had the minister over and they asked him, he asked him the question, there were pogroms going on and off every couple of years at that time. And anti-Semitism is definitely a constant. And I always say, when I say this story over, if you don't believe Chazal, you might as well believe, I forget what this guy's name was, but you might as well believe this Dutch minister when he says it. So the Passan asked him, and on that Sunday this minister had given his drasha, his sermon, about how terrible the pogroms in Russia are, and everyone's at fault for it, etc., 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 etc. Okay, so fact. So he asked him the question, what is the real cause of anti-Semitism? So, as I say, if you don't believe Chazal, you might as well believe a Dutch minister. He says, yeah, you should believe Chazal, but you don't want to believe Chazal, at least believe a Dutch minister. He says, there is a mystery about the Jews that fascinates and repels us, that simultaneously attracts and repels. And that is, they are God's people. They are identified as God's people. And this is a direct quote now. And we means nations of the world, really hate God and want to oppose His law. But we can't. So instead, we fight with the Jews. So I say, if you don't want to believe Chazal... wait a second. Now, Chazal said more or less the same thing. Now, the point is, now he has a different story. See, this is a different thing, and this is why I like the book, The Prime Ministers, because there's what's said in public is said for public consumption. And what's said behind closed doors is always a little bit different and much more revealing about who a person is. So Van Passen, as long as we're on Van Passen, I'll tell you another Van Passen story. Another Van Passen story was, he was in Romania in the late 20s, And he goes to one of the leaders of the Jewish, Romanian Jewish community and says to him, tell me, how's life for Jews in Romania? So this person says, life for Jews in Romania is great. We consider ourselves Romanian. We are very welcome here. We can do whatever we want. You want me to show you how welcome we are here? Watch. I could call the foreign minister right now and have a conversation with him. Dials his phone, picks him up. Hello, foreign minister. Mr. What's going on? Can I speak to you tomorrow, next week about something? No problem. See, he hangs up the phone, tells Van Passen. Yeah, tells Van Passen, you see, we're very welcome here. Okay, Van Passen, a couple of days later, has a meeting with the foreign minister of Romania, who this head of the Jewish community just called. He says to him, tell me, what's Romania's policy about Jews? So the foreign minister says to him, tell me, you're Jewish? He says, no, tell the truth, I'm not Jewish. He said, well, if you're not Jewish, I'll tell you. The truth is, we hate the Jews in Romania, and we'd love to get rid of them if we could.
I heard it, actually.
And maybe I told it to you. Okay, anyway.
Question.
Yeah, yes, Feldman.
So, did the Ramban live under Saint
Louis? No, the Ramban lived in Spain under James II, King of Aragon.
Saint James?
No.
Saint Louis initiated the expulsion?
No, Saint Louis did not initiate the expulsion, but he did two key moves, which, like, he, I wouldn't say made it inevitable, but he created the atmosphere. A, he took away the physical way Jews physically make money, and he also spiritually attacked the Jews and took away Shas, and the yeshivas closed down. And so it's like, it's true the Jews weren't really expelled from France for another 35, 40 years, but it wasn't, you know, the Jewish community had lost its vitality, as they say.
A serious question. What is that guy who wrote that book, Doing Such a Guy Shakab? Hey, how can you, like, look at those stupid things. I'm surprised that man is known for peace. Nonsense. He literally, like, he burnt shots. He took down their government back.
I'll tell you something. This book is also written for public consumption. And I don't personally know the man. Consumption. That means the people at large and the world at large are invited to listen to it and read it. And when you write for the public, you have to toe a more politically correct line. It's officially part of Cambridge medieval textbooks.
Cambridge.
So I'm not sure. There are ways to figure it out. Just wait a second. We're going to go on now in the Ramban's life. The Ramban, very important. The Ramban, the next important thing. The next important thing in the Ramban's life is his debate. No, it was with friars of the Dominican, of friars were people who were monks.
Well, they're before monks.
Well, before monks, whatever. Okay, whatever they were. I'm not sure if that's true.
Is this
I'm not sure if
that's true. Life?
No.
Or they have
no. Feldman, please.
I'm sorry. Keep going.
Okay. He had a debate with a number of friars. One of them's name was Paul. He was also known as Pablos Christianus. He was a Jewish convert to Christianity. So the Ramban, being very straightforward, said they wanted him to debate. And the Ramban says, listen, I don't want to waste my time. Let's talk about the meat of the topic. The meat of the topic, which is three issues. Has Mashiach come yet, like the Christians claim? What is Mashiach? Is Mashiach going to be a person or going to be Ki'ilu God, like the Christians claim? And thirdly, who's really keeping the true Torah today, Jews or Christians? Yeah, as Feldman is can you believe they actually had to debate this? Yes, they had to debate it. It was a hot topic.
Who did this debate? The Ramban against...
The Ramban against... Almost 800 years ago.
Sounds like a soccer match.
It's almost 800 years ago.
The second point?
The second point was, who is Mashiach?
Is he God or...
Is he Ki'ilu a regular person who becomes Mashiach? Or he's Ki'ilu... God.
I think it's obvious from Yeshaya that it's a man,
because
it could have been.
So what in fact happened was the Ramban. Obviously, we have to realize that, you know, the concept of freedom of speech had not yet really been born. And Ramban was definitely nervous.
Wasn't he granted freedom of speech?
He refused to debate. He refused to debate until they gave him freedom of speech. He refused to debate, and they finally gave him freedom of speech. But of course, he did not have absolute freedom of speech. He said, I want the right to speak, you know, freely. But I, you know, he said, I'm going to speak with tact, with tact, even though it's, you know, not fair because they didn't have to really speak with tact.
Yes.
And tact. They were able to say whatever they wanted, and there was no problems at all. Now,
was it a one-on-one or was it like?
No, it was not. It was one against at least three, if not four or five. Just a minute. If I'm done, please don't interrupt. Okay. Okay. I guess I'll say it this way because this is like for the records here.
You can turn it off and say it differently.
Maybe I will in a minute. But first, let me say something for the records.
Yeah,
they'll just have to get in touch with me. They'll die of curiosity. We've done worse things, haven't we? Okay. Okay. Yeah. Wait a second. General historians.
People that are curious.
General historians. Falden!
054-313-3030.
It's only an Israeli number, though.
Yeah, but you can call me from America. Okay. General historians, Keilu, are not sure who won the debate. They're not sure who won the debate. If you read the Ramban's record of the debate, you don't really have that much of a question. I don't have that much of a really good question. If you think if you don't know who the Ramban is, then you could really doubt the Ramban's word. But if you know who the Ramban is, The Ramban in the debate records. I thought it was for you. The Ramban in the debate says, "I'm writing over the way it happened without adding or subtracting." So it's like this gets down to a very deep issue, which, you know, I had extensive discussions with Rav Benny about. Yeah, I know you might find that hard to believe, but yes, that's awesome. I did have extensive discussions with Rav Benny about this one.
Everybody's
left now?
Eisner. Is that a joke?
Everybody knows Rav Benny.
Everyone knows him as Rav Benny. But I had extensive discussions with Rav Benny about this.
No, I don't mean that. Everybody knows him as Rav Benny. Yeah. Everybody knows.
Yeah, everyone. Yeah. Okay. So it's.
That is the statement.
It's really, you know. It's exasperating to a certain extent. On one hand, he's like more. You know, he's like he has like a slightly different approach from me in this. Look, this is like a constant theme. Which starts here, and we're going to keep running into it from here on, as far as I know, is when someone of the Ramban stature, or somewhat similar to this, says something, should you significantly doubt what he's saying?
Mm-hmm.
And it's definitely a clear affront to the Ramban's stature as a Talmud Chacham to significantly doubt what he says.
What?
And that. Okay, problem? Not now. It's practically 7 o'clock. You're confused, okay? I think if you have any real appreciation for who the Ramban was as a Talmud Chacham and a Mavakish Ebbes, then you will not doubt it.
Oh.
It's not, you know, if you're in the world at large views the Ramban as one source and the record that these monks, these friars left over as a different source, then views them as equal sources. Anyway, so if you really want the clearest proof that the Ramban won the debate, he had to run away from Spain not long after the debate was over. And he even though he did come to Eretz Yisrael, as we will see, he probably wouldn't have left Spain if his life wouldn't have more or less been in danger. Similarly, the Ramban says that the king paid him for his part in the, you know, gave him money afterwards. The king definitely didn't have to do, which definitely indicates that the king felt the Ramban, you know, presented well. So I don't really think that there's really much of a question. Okay, just wait a second. Now, getting on to the moving
are there
on.
Any significant differences between the
wrong? Absolutely are very significant differences. I've never seen the other side of the story. I mean, frankly speaking, I said already that I know who the Ramban was.
I understand.
I'm not saying that I would be interested as a historian in seeing it, but I don't think it's right, is not even the right words, to treat the Ramban as an equal to Friar Paul and Raymond is just, you know.
I'm saying for the sake of like knowing what they changed.
Okay, it would be interesting to see, but I'm not, you know, this is a once a week class that I spend a lot of time preparing anyway. And in order to like speak intelligently about something like that, I would have to have spent a lot longer working on it, and I just don't have that time. You know, whatever.
Where is the source? Where is the Ramban wrote this down?
The Ramban wrote this down. It's printed in Kisvei Ramban, Vikuach HaRamban.
This entire thing about the debate?
The entire here, the Vikuach HaRamban.
Let me go there, like, videotape them, that would be sick. They made a movie out of it. It's obviously, they have a movie.
Who knows? I'll tell you what my father says about Apollo 13.
No, I'm saying,
quiet. My father says about, and he was personally involved in Apollo 13 and knew some of the people firsthand. My father says, is the basic facts of the movie are right? Yes, there was an energy cell explosion, which meant they would not be allowed to land on the moon. And yes, they managed, yes, they managed to get Apollo 13 back. The actual portrayals of the people involved in the movie Apollo 13 were just completely wrong.
Did you follow the rocket surgeon?
Scientist. Elman, enough. Okay, we have to finish off the Ramban. To finish off the Ramban, we're going to talk about Ramban's Perush on Chumash. That's where we're going to finish off the Ramban. The Ramban wrote on Chumash near the end of his life. It's possible he started it before the debate, but that's not absolutely clear. You can see from the Ramban, he explicitly says, commenting about Kavarachal, in Brachos Lamed Hei Tazayin, that's in Parshas Vayishlach. He says one pshat in what Kivras Haaretz means, and then he says a different pshat. He says after Hashem, after I'm Zochen, I came there to Shul, I can now tell you a different pshat in Kivras Haaretz. So you see, the Ramban wrote it at the end of his life. Chumash in Ramban and Chumash is Mashlum, completes Rashi. In a way very similar to Tosus and Shas, as we know, and that is...
Yeah, Reb Chaim
Volozhin
says it.
And also the Chassam Sofer says it. The same again, the same time. The Mamish, the same time. The Chassam Sofer was maybe 15 years younger than Reb Chaim Volozhin, and there's no reason to believe that the two are connected to each other. Feldman, that is a dumb... Feldman.
That's
a great thing. Okay. It's really an astounding accomplishment. Because the Ramban, as we could see, was well after Rashi. And that the Ramban is able to like jump back 2, 3, 4 Doros and he'll do something that the Tosafot did. It's unbelievable. Now the Ramban in Chumash is very, very important. Because, you know, again, it's similar to Tosafot. The Rashi is absolutely unbelievable. And I like... Rashi is like something else. Rashi is like... the depth of Rashi is so stunning, you don't know what to say about it sometimes. And everywhere, constantly. But we would never know what to do if we didn't have other people there helping us along, because Rashi just does it all in the background in such a subtle fashion that you might not even realize he's doing anything. About a number of major topics, it's impossible to really know ki'ilu what Rashi held, even though you could... There's ways to substantiate. In other words, we see Rashi's subtlety, you know, deep, like subtlety of surgical precision in Rashi, over and over so many times. It's like hard to believe that you know he wasn't aware of issue A, B, C, and D, which we're going to talk about some of them later, not now. However, that's what we need the Ramban for. The Ramban's really the Rebbe, the teacher of how you learn Chumash. Rashi, you look at Rashi, you don't really realize everything he's doing. He's so subtle. The Ramban's out in the open. The problem, of course, is the style of the Ramban is somewhat stunted. And it's like he'll ask a question with one word and say an answer with three. And it takes time to digest and, you know, appreciate the Ramban. Of course, you know, the big stuff in the Ramban, the big explosions, whether they're in Pshat or in Hashkafa, Machshava, etc., 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 those are much more accessible and known to the world at large. But like the real depth of Ramban and Chumash is something that takes years to appreciate. And it's just very critical. The Ramban is very critical in terms of understanding Midrashim, how to relate to Chazal, etc., etc., etc. The Ramban is really like the determiner what to do with Mikra and Agadata more than practically Enum anyway. He's like the first significant step. Yeah, it's not that Rashi didn't do anything. It's just from Rashi, Rashi is so subtle and in the background, you can practically do anything with Rashi. It's the Ramban who's more out in the open that we're able to in an intelligent fashion go on. Say again. Ramban attacks Rashi. He asks on Rashi, and as they say, the Kavod HaTorah is asking on somebody. And the Ramban in his Hakdama to Rashi says, Hakdama to Chumash says, Va'asim umor panai shnei manoah. Yeah, I have it right here. I don't even have to say it about that. You guys don't mind waiting one more minute? I should be able to find it right here.
Why did the Rebbe hate the Ramban?
That is such an inaccurate statement. I refuse to answer it. I refuse to answer. Just wait a second. Maybe it's not in this one. It's Kisvei. It's like they included a lot of things, but I don't know. Just let me see in the beginning and see if they did. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, the Ramban says the Asim Lamar Panai. I will put as lights in front of my face. Pnei Menorah, the two menorahs hataharos, the two pure candelabras. One of them is Rashi. Pirushi Rabbeinu Shlomo Ateres Tzvi V'Tiferes, whatever, I can't remember the whole thing. Rashi, who's crowned by a beautiful crown, etc., etc., etc. Muhtar Mini Muso, crowned by his achievements, the Mikra of the Mishnah of Gemara. And then Ramban says, I'm going to work on him, I'm going to ask on him. It doesn't mean just because you realize the depth and breadth of Rashi's accomplishments, doesn't mean that you don't ask on him. Kachi Darko Shel Torah. No. V'im Rabbeinu, V'im Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra, Yihia Lanu Tachacha Magula, open rebuke. He is the second one. Yeah, that's the point. That's like the complexity and sophistication here. It's true. It's Tachacha Magula Va'ahava Musutara, open rebuke and hidden love. And the fact that he equates him to Rashi as one of the two lights in the pure candelabra shows you that it's true. He does give it to Ibn Ezra in a number of well-known places, but that doesn't take away from Ibn Ezra's accomplishments in Parshanos HaMikra. It's just that Ibn Ezra is whatever. It's not. He has certain times on Ibn Ezra in Kan Mekama, and we're going to call it here for the night. That's done.